Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Painlessly Add a Graphic HMI. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, here with today's presenters, Todd Valenz of LXD Research and Display, and Terry West of Sirius Integrated. I'll start off by more formally introducing our speakers, the first of whom is Todd Valenz, the president of LXD Research and Display. Todd has been in the LCD display industry for 23 years, focusing on applications for embedded solutions used in industrial, medical, and outdoor environments. His focus is working with engineers to help them design in LCDs and any other value-added components required for a specific application, such as touch panels and customization. And prior to his current role, Todd held previous positions, including VP of Sales and Marketing, Director of Engineering, Project Manager, and as a design engineer. Our second presenter today is Terry West, CEO of Sirius Integrated. Terry has more than 25 years of experience building new embedded technology business at Intel, Microchip, and RIM. As the first employee of RIM in 1988, Mr. West fueled the early growth of the company while developing the technologies and customer relationships that led to the RIM BlackBerry. At Intel, Terry managed an Xscale processor internal startup from first shipment to an $85 million run rate in less than 3 years, led a $300 million acquisition, and developed and marketed numerous software plus silicon plus tools platform technologies for the embedded market. At Microchip, Mr. West launched their flagship line of 32-bit microcontrollers and directed a comprehensive reengineering of their global customer-facing marketing presence. Now on to a few housekeeping items before we begin. Today's event consists of roughly 50 minutes of presentation with 10 minutes at the end for audience Q&A. Directing your attention to the audience viewing console, the Enlarge Slides button will maximize the presentation slides to fill your entire screen. The download slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you prefer to follow along with a hard copy. The Forward to a Friend button allows you to send an email that includes a registration to this registration link to this eCast so that your friends and colleagues can also attend. Importantly, the Ask a Question text box allows you to participate in the event by simply typing your questions into the box and hitting the Submit Question button below. You can submit questions at any time during the course of the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often while you're reviewing the material. We'll address as many of these questions as possible during the closing Q&A session, and if you have questions about the eCast operation itself, feel free to submit those, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist. A final reminder before we start is that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. So at this point, we can get started, and I'd like to hand it off to Todd Valenz of LXD Research and Display. Take it away, Todd.
Okay. Well, hello, everyone. Hope everybody's doing good today. Today, I'm going to talk about the LCD technologies and selecting an LCD display, and then actually, when I'm finished, then my co-host, Terry West, will talk about the platform technologies and selecting those components and software and so forth. In selecting an LCD, there are a lot of different criteria in doing that, and a lot of it has to do a lot of times with your application and the industry you're trying to serve. With these type of products, I mean, industrial, medical, automotive, can have a lot of criteria related to temperature, humidity, gloves, and different types of temperatures and so forth. And consumer side of it, typically cost is a big factor. Not that it isn't in the other applications, but consumer gets very cost conscious. So when you look for an LCD partner, you want to look for technical capabilities. Do they have technical support? Can they supply product worldwide? And so forth, and those types of things. And then once you've selected your LCD partner, then you want to consider how you're going to drive this LCD. So a system on the module partner, like Sirius, is a good way to do that. This is a kind of a graphical, it gives you an idea of how an LCD module is put together. This particular example has a complete touch panel and so forth. So with a capacitive touch sensor, you would have a cover lens, then you would have the touch sensor, then you would have the LCD glass itself, and then your backlight on the bottom. And in a lot of cases, there's, bonding characteristics, optical optimizations, and How do you connect to the main board, whether it's an FPC or wire harness and so forth? Sizes and resolutions, typically LCDs are measured in a diagonal. You'll hear 3.5, 4.3, 7-inch, 10.1, 10.4, and so forth. So basically in all those sizes, there's two basic aspect ratios. One is 4:3, which gives you a little more of a rectangular shape. And then the more popular ones today are the wide format, 16:9, 16:10, typically what you see on your newer laptops. So when you look at those aspect ratios, it kind of gives you a correlation of what the actual resolutions are. You know your standard 4:3 aspect ratio on a VGA resolution, 640 by 480. And then if you go to the wide format, then it becomes 800 by 480. So it does increase. You want to use standard sizes wherever possible. You know, as the LCD glass today for TFTs, there's probably less than 10 companies that actually manufacture the glass itself, where companies like ourselves, we take it and we add all the other components that you saw on the previous slide and make a module out of it. So standard sizes are the best, and obviously they're the most popular, and if you can stick with those sizes, basically you'll get your best pricing and most cost-effective solution. When you look at different TFT technologies, there are about three basic ones. TN, which is your twisted pneumatic, is your most cost-effective solution. Is what used in most applications. The one downside on the TN is that you have one inversion gray inversion where it's not optimal to view the display on that viewing angle. The multiple domain vertical aligned and the IPS panels are the ones that are you're very familiar with on your smartphone and iPads and so forth, where you can, you know, turn the display all around and you get full viewing in all of those directions. Backlights is another critical part in designing your display for your application. You can get backlights in different brightnesses, and they have different they're for different requirements. 250 is the 300 nits is typically what you find on your laptop. They don't need to be real bright. They're used indoors. If you take your laptop outside, you'll see that you really can't read it. So as you get to these higher brightnesses, that's where you can use these displays outside. Your iPhones and so forth are probably around 600 nits, and they're viewable. 800 nit displays are typically because you have some sort of a touch panel on it, so the transmissivity is reduced a little bit, and then 1,000 nits, then they're really designed for the direct sunlight. Lifetime of an LCD display is basically determined by the backlight, the LEDs. As we all know, heat and humidity don't do them well. You know, older displays were designed around 20,000 hours normal, and that's what we call the half-life. Half-life means that the brightness of the display is reduced by 50%. So if you have a 500-nit display, after 20,000 hours, it would go down to 250 nits. More common today is what you'll see in 30,000 hours. And then for a small premium, we can get backlights that have 50,000-hour to half-life. Power. This is sometimes an issue for battery applications. Typically, all these backlights are LED strings in series and parallel combinations, require constant current. Most of them run off of 9 volt to 23 volts. We do have some modules where we actually integrate the power supply, so you don't have to generate the 9 and 23 volts or whatever's needed. You can just supply it with your regular supply. Kind of an example of a backlight data sheet. You'll see the parallel series configurations of the LEDs and then what the current requirements are and the voltages that are needed to do that. Viewing angle is also critical. It's measured in degrees. You know, your TN, TFT is the most cost-effective solutions, have the grayscale inversion, as I mentioned earlier. So there's always one, either vertical side or the underside of the display that is not very readable. So we always say it's either 6 o'clock or 12 o'clock optimal viewing. So if it's 12 o'clock optimal viewing, the 6 o'clock side doesn't view very well. One of the things that has come up in the last couple of years to help improve that is what we call optical viewing films. These are films that basically is a low-cost solution to make your TN display look seem like an IPS panel. It overcomes the grayscale problems. There is a little bit of a penalty on the brightness of the display. It could reduce the display, you know, 15-20%. In most of those cases, what we do is just beef up the backlight a little bit and make it a little bit brighter to compensate for that. But it's great for taking a low-cost TN, TFT display and make it so you can use it in both portrait and landscape modes. Now, the best displays for full viewing angles is the IPS and MVA displays, but they are also the most price premium panels. Here's kind of a chart showing typical viewing angles. You can see the TN where it's highlighted there in yellow, showing you the gray inversion angles that you don't get a very good angle. But if you take the OVA at the bottom, you can see how it takes that same panel and makes the display more uniform in all viewing angles. And then, as you can see, IPS is really the best there. Touch technologies is another option that many customers are looking for today. Resistive touch, still very popular, very cost-effective, works with thick gloves, good for outdoor applications, and they are, they're typically single touch. They're not pinch and swipe type touch panels. Most of the applications used for these are some kind of an operator interface for pushing buttons and so forth and doing those types of things. Capacitive touch definitely has become a lot more popular with cell phones, smartphones, and iPads and so forth. They're more expensive. Typically, the controller for the touch panel is built as part of the touch sensor itself. It's usually on the black circuits coming off of it. Resistive touch requires calibration when you first integrate it, where with capacitive touch you don't need to do that. It's already been pre-calibrated before the user would use it. Many of the cap touches today with some of the new touch sensors and firmware that's available, they're more tolerant to the water and gloves. So, and there are a couple other niche technologies. There's SAWS, which is sound acoustical wave, and IR. Typically those technologies are used on very large screens where you'll see the weatherman using as he's doing their weather reports these days. Here just kind of shows you a pictorial example of those technologies. One's obviously there's no touch, there's no cover glass. Resistive, most of those are bonded on there. They're typically the same size as your LCD display, so they fit right over the same area. And then in the bottom right there, you'll see that's a capacitive. You'll see that the glass, the cover glass that goes around that is larger than the actual display. Most cover glass, you can put lenses in them. You can black out the lenses for cameras, sensors, whatever you'd like. Those are typically can all be customized. There are several other options. We talked about there's different bonding for different applications. If it's outdoor, you typically want to do an optical bond. If it's an indoor application, we would do what we call perimeter bonding of a touch panel, and basically just double-sided adhesive tape that's very strong to hold the touch panel down. There are several optical and mechanical films and coatings where you can put on the displays for improving viewing angles, anti-reflection, anti-glare, anti-fingerprint, or anti-smudge, we sometimes call it, as well as anti-shatter and anti-shard. We can put a film on it if you have an application where you can't have any broken glass or anything protrude from the display and would cut somebody. That's very prominent in the medical industry. The flex circuits that extend from these displays and touch sensors can be customized. Cover glass, I mentioned, we can customize those as well. There's lots of different cap touch controllers out there, price, features. Typically, we use the ones that fit our applications and our touch panels the best. There are different display interface options. You have RGB, which is your red, green, blue with H-Sync and V-Sync. You have LVDS interfaces. Some of the small displays, you know, 3.5 inch and smaller, can use, may have a microprocessor interface on it. So it would actually have a controller right on it with a memory, and you can just drive the display. There's EMI and RFI shielding that you need to take in account, and then your enclosures. Sometimes we can do open frame designs and provide you with part of the enclosure, as well as you, if nothing else, you want to take the enclosure in account when we do the design of the LCD display to make it fit the way you need. Some customers need IP65 for waterproofing and so forth, so you want to work with those kinds of things as well. So when you select, obviously, an LCD display, the key elements are make sure we have technical support, responsiveness, worldwide delivery, can you do warehousing, just-in-time, Kanban programs. These are all things that LXD supports. And then also have an end-of-life management program. One thing with LCDs is that typically they will have anywhere from a 3 to 5, maybe even a 7-year life if the usage is really high. So there's always a chance that the LCD itself will go end-of-life. And the size itself might stay the same, but the actual part might change a little bit. Could be a drop-in, might not be. So you need to make sure with whoever supplier you're working with that they have an end-of-life management system to help you work through all of those. You want to have factories that have quality systems that I've listed there. And then, you know, do a visit. Visit the factory and, you know, look at their quality and see how they're putting these things together, because there are a lot of different companies out there, and some are better than others. So, and with that was my side of it. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Terry.
Thanks, Todd. And so we're going to talk, transitioned into talking more at the platform level about the HMI problem. We're going to duck briefly into IoT, but this webinar is primarily about HMI. But before we get too detailed into the platform area of things, I want to kind of tailgate on Todd's conversation a little bit about LCDs. There are probably many reasons why you signed up or are listening to this webinar. And we started with the LCD problem because typically, and we've seen this many, many times over the years as we've engaged with customers around HMI opportunities, that people say, hey, I need to find glass. And they go out on Alibaba or something, and they find a piece of glass, or they get some samples, and they from a local rep or whoever it is, and they start playing with glass. Maybe get a dev kit from Renesas or some of the other, you know, embedded controller companies, and wire it up. So the tendency is to focus on the glass as opposed to the glass supplier, because you're focused on technology as opposed to kind of getting to market. So I want to encourage you to think, or really what Todd just talked about in terms of the supply chain aspects and your partner selection, because it matters more in many cases than the glass itself. Obviously, you need an LCD that meets your needs with the right specs and the right price. But I want to kind of give you a little bit of background of Sirius, not because I'm trying to promote Sirius here, but because I want to share the experience that we've had in choosing a supplier and a supply chain and products in the LCD industry. So as experts in the HMI business and HMIOT business at the module level and the platform level, we've had to obviously work with LCD vendors throughout the years. And quite frankly, I can unabashedly, because I'm not Todd, I can give him an endorsement saying that LXD for us has been an incredible supplier. The reason, though, let me drill down on the reasons. And the reasons are primarily around changement and communication and technical support and quality. And I mean, we could go on. It's the same list that Todd just talked about. But these are really, really important. And let me give you some examples. And integrity. I think that seems obvious, right, that you'd want a supplier with integrity. But let me give you some horror stories to give you an idea of what we've experienced, because we've seen it all. I feel like the State Farm guy. You know, we know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two. I had a sales guy from a LCD manufacturer in my office, gosh, this is probably 6 years ago. And he looked me in the eye and said, look at this new 7-inch LCD. He said, it's only, and he gave me a price, and I went, wow, that's pretty good. And he said, this is, and I said, well, what about longevity? Because as Todd just mentioned, you know, long life supply is always tricky, right? And he's, oh, it just went to production, and it's on your embedded roadmap, and so we think 5-7 years. And I went, wow, this is, of course, I'm going to use the words too good to be true, right? Because it sounded that way. So we took the glass and we looked at it, and he promised a data sheet and stuff like that. And fortunately, we've got relationships in Asia, and so we worked some of our contacts. And I said, hey, do you know what this is? I took a little picture of the serial number on the back and everything. I said, does anybody know what this is? And it turned out that the piece of glass that this fellow was in front of me pushing was end of life already. It had been end of life. It wasn't a 7-inch piece of glass. It was a 6.8-inch piece of glass. So it was slightly non-standard size. It had been end of life. And there were 20,000 pieces sitting in a warehouse in Hong Kong that were partially seconds with missing pixels that somebody was looking to get rid of at a very cheap price. So integrity really does matter in this business. You want to know that you're getting what you're getting. You want to know the straight story. And what that illustrates through that example is the value of understanding your supply chain all the way back as far as you can and having partners that through the supply chain really work this. And so when Todd said, go visit the factory, he really means it. You know, my manufacturing director, Dave, a couple weeks ago, went with Todd's colleague Charles and visited their factory in China, actually walked the floor and saw them putting product together. We know the LEDs that are inside and where they come from in the backlight. We know, and so you can't be completely immune to end of life or things like that, which Todd talked about, but what you can be is aware and have partners that help you through that process. So I just can't emphasize enough that, you know, stuff always happens, right? You know, quality issues, even if you're ISO and all these kinds of things, the odd time you're going to have something happen that you didn't expect, being able to call somebody to work through it. Todd and I were just on the phone this morning talking about an issue around a 7-inch cap touch piece of glass where one of the voltages on the glass on the touch controller wasn't measuring correctly. Okay, so I've got two suppliers. One supplier I tried to my chagrin and made a mistake. And so I came back to Todd and said, and apologized. but this other supplier, we had a problem with the capacitive touch layer. It was seeing phantom touches. Okay, so we went back to that supplier of the LCD, because it's not just an LCD now. It's an LCD module with a touch controller, with software on the touch controller, and all this kind of stuff. And I said, okay, now, how do I fix this problem where I'm getting phantom touches on the touch controller? The problem is that supplier who said they had support and said they had all these things didn't. And so they had absolutely no ability to modify the program on the touch controller and the tuning on the touch controller to fix the issue. I'm convinced it was a programming issue, but it could have been an actual sensor design issue. But unfortunately, they didn't have the technical expertise because they basically bought a bunch of parts from third parties and put them together as an assembly house versus having technical expertise in-house. And this comes down to the very simple things like getting step files, for instance, and data sheets and things like that that are clear from your manufacturer. We're working on a new project, Todd and I, together on a new board. It's a 10-inch. We call it the Street Fighter. It's meant to be a low-cost, relatively speaking, Street Fighter module around the 10-inch glass, something that, 10.1-inch wide is a really nice piece of glass. And so I went to Todd and said, he's given me a data sheet. We've designed it together to fit the industrial marketplace with several options. And then I went back and we said, hey, can I get a step file from you or a SolidWorks model for this so I can integrate it into my mechanicals? And so he's got a mechanical engineer on staff to go deliver that. So these are the kinds of things that you wouldn't normally think about when you just go online and say, I'm looking for it, and you look at the data sheet. Right, there's a lot more to this selection and partnership process that you really have to pay attention to. Because if you don't pay attention to those other things, let me tell you, as an engineer or as a supply chain person, you will pay for this. You'll pay for it later, big time. And we have. I mean, we went to market with a 3-inch LCD. Todd said, "Don't do it." I should have paid attention. This was 4 or 5 years ago. We are actually down a path with a customer, a non-standard size. We did the supply chain investigation, found out it was being manufactured, the raw glass, apparently by 3 different factories. What we didn't understand is that piece of glass was actually being used by a GPS product manufacturer out of Korea that was making those little golf GPSs that you walk around on the golf course with. And all of the quantity from all 3 factories was feeding into that one customer. And that customer decided they were going to change models and get rid of that glass, and the whole thing went away. So the dangers of the supply chain have to be navigated very carefully, and you need partners to do that. Certainly, we spend, as Sirius, a lot of energy working with Todd and the team at LXD to understand the supply chain across all we're doing so that we can manage changes. We've got one module where we've actually replaced the glass 3 times now, and our customers get a form-fit-function identical product year after year after year, even though we've replaced the glass 3 times. Because of either underlying quality issues in the manufacturer that created the raw glass, where it started to get a little, we weren't comfortable with the quality metrics they were producing, or in the second case, a touch controller or a controller on board went end of life and we had to change. So having visibility, you absolutely have to have people on that process. This is a supply chain management problem. This is an engineering challenge. It is not free. And you definitely have to do that. So let's transition into some more of the slides here. As we transition from the LCD world to the platform world. Okay, so there are some big architectural drivers in the HMI world. And when you look at these elements, these are the things that create incredible havoc in the engineering and architectural process when you go and embark on this HMI path. And actually, I'll do a little plug for our new podcast on SiriusIntegrated.com. If you go under About Podcast somewhere or an iTunes store, you can find Sirius Integrated. We have a new podcast, and what we're really hammering a lot in this podcast is to bring real-world interesting things at the very high level, whether it's IoT data, whether it's the one we're just working on right now is something around liability management of customers, which you go, what the heck, liability management? Yeah, because liability management at your customers is driving them to ask training videos on your HMI, and training videos means that you need video, which you said, I never need video, that's outside the scope of my product. So that these high-level things that are happening out there are driving some very interesting things about LCD resolution, usage models, whether you need video or you don't need video, whether you need animation, what kind of frame rates. We've talked a lot about scalability and about longevity. Can you buy that same LCD? But there's lots of aspects to longevity, right? There's component longevity and all those things. We'll talk about that a bit more. Software, I visit a lot of customers, a lot of engineers every year. And I can't remember how many years ago it was when I walked into a team and they had more senior software engineers just lying around doing nothing than just despair. It doesn't happen. Software is always the bottleneck. And when you go to HMI, software becomes an incredible driver in your project completion. Connectivity and IoT, now that's a weird one to stick in there. Certainly, An HMI that is disconnected from the world doesn't do anything. It has to be able to talk to a machine. But there are some implications for IoT back on HMI. And then that drives some interesting questions about distributed unified architectures and your time and cost, time to market, cost to market, time to sustain, cost to sustain type of questions. So let's go through some of these a little deeper, because when you embark on this path, it would be better if you chose the right path first, okay? And I'll come back to that in a minute. But LCD resolutions. Todd talked about standard resolutions, and I've listed some of them here, right? 320 by 240 is your normal size for 3.5-inch type HMI. 480 by 272 is the most standard. 480 by 272, 4.3-inch, is the most popular screen on the planet, industrial space. Okay, it's the standard. Now, 7-inch at 800 by 480 wide VGA is also extremely popular. That's a real close second and probably first soon, because everybody loves those nice big 7-inch type screens. 5-inch is coming online with that same size. And then, of course, at 7-inch, you've got both the wide VGA as well as the kind of that middle bandwidth, 1024 by 600. And then at 600, at 10-inch, you end up in the 1280 by 800, almost like a 720p type screen. Okay, and those are the kind of the standard sizes. And you may go, wow, that's lower resolution than I'm used to. And the answer is, yeah. These aren't consumer products or phones or tablets where a retina display or these ultra-high density displays are required. They typically are built on factories a few generations older than what Samsung or Apple would build a several billion-dollar factory to supply their needs. There's, like Todd said, there's about 10 raw glass manufacturers, the people that make the actual liquid crystal display glass. And these folks want to maximize their infrastructure value. It costs millions and millions of dollars to run a fab, and they want to maximize the ability. And the lower the resolution, the easier it is, the higher the quality is around the yields of their glass. And so you tend to get slightly lower resolutions as the most popular. You can certainly go higher, but if you look at resolutions, and I've listed here the amount of data that you need to allocate in your frame buffer in your hardware for two frames, because typically you run, you know, let's say 24-bit color. 16-bit color is getting pretty old right now. 16-bit color only gives you 65,000 different colors. And you say, well, that's a lot of colors. But if you watch your Netflix at night or your Hulu at night and your bandwidth is a little limited, you'll notice when they show gradients on the screen or the dark patterns, you'll get these little little lines in your darks. That happens when you have a limited color palette. And more these days, when you create a modern-looking UI, you've got gradients in the UI, and they're very subtle. Microsoft, one of their big features in Windows 10 creator of the latest update, was subtle gradients in things. I mean, really, that's one of their big 10 features. It's kind of crazy. But UI-wise, that's becoming really important. If you don't have 24-bit color, you can't get those gradients. You can't get that subtle look. And it may not seem important, but it really makes a difference in terms of how professional and how modern your product looks. So we're seeing 24-bit color really start to take over. 16-bit color goes away. The problem with that is it doubles the amount of data. Obviously, microprocessor people don't think in terms of 24 bits. They think in terms of 32 bits. So you do a byte for every single pixel, and you need these 32-bit frame buffers, and you need two of them, one for the drawing frame and one for the current frame. You draw in the background, and then you flip it forward. And so the screen shows the current, and you draw on the background, and you do that double buffering all the time. But look at the amount of data. At a simple little quarter VGA screen, you need 600K bytes for your frame data. But when you start for two frames at 32-bit color, et cetera, you start getting to these big screens, and you're looking at 8 megabytes of data just for your frame buffer. And then you look down and say, okay, let's look at how much of bandwidth out of your RAM you need in your system just to feed the display at 60 frames per second, right? You got to pull that frame out of the display buffer, display it on the screen. Something, DMA or a video engine, is taking that data, every single pixel, delivering it to the screen, and you have to actually change it. So if you're changing screens from one screen to another, maybe doing a flood fill, going to the green screen, going to the menu, it takes bandwidth. And then if you actually add, and you want some level of responsiveness, right? So here, let's make this real practical. You're looking at a screen that you've developed with your HMI, and you push one of the menu buttons. How long does it take before your next screen comes up, like your settings screen, whatever it is? If it's more than 50 to 100 milliseconds, your screen feels slow and sluggish. People go, why isn't this snappy? Is this old? What's going on? And it reflects in your product. And that drives the amount of bandwidth you need to be able to clear the screen, flip frame buffers, and all that kind of thing. Now, if you start doing video, 24 frames per second video is YouTube quality, that kind of thing, you need even more bandwidth. And you start looking at this kind of bandwidth, and you go, wait a minute, look at the 172 megahertz out of the RAM. Okay, and there's some assumptions underneath that are very reasonable in terms of how wide your RAM is and all that kind of thing. And that drives how much RAM you need and what kind of RAM you need and how fast it has to run. And you'll notice there's this incredible variance in the type of MCU and the type of RAM needed to support these solutions, right? So if you try to go to a processor vendor and say, hey, give me a processor that'll do some level of scalability, which you say, hey, I don't need scalability. Oh, yes, you do. Your marketing team will never figure out what they want until you give them the first one, and then they'll guarantee they'll come back and say they need something different. We have a customer who delivered 4.3-inch modules to their customer downstream. Their customer downstream swore up and down they only needed 4.3 because they didn't want to pay for 7-inch, right? They delivered the 4.3 solution. The customer shipped them all back and said, we want 7-inch. Magically, they found the budget in the BOM cost. So if they had created a solution around MCU and RAM that was 4.3 targeted, and that MCU couldn't support a 7-inch screen, they would have had to start all their software and all their hardware from scratch. So this concept of scalability is incredibly important across your product line. So you and the amount of memory and the bandwidth you need drives a lot of difficult decisions around processors and architectures. Okay. Longevity, scalability. So we've talked about scalability. How do you scale your user experience, your UX, and your HMI for a range of cost and size products? That's tough, right? This MCU problem. How do you reuse your software investment, your knowledge? So if you have to change processors or change processor families, are you reusing your software investment? Does the same tools work down at 3.5 to 4.3 or whatever the span of your products would be? How do you leverage and track evolving software and connectivity? So if you do it all yourself, how do you stay up to date, really, is the hard problem. And this list of questions are things you have to answer. How do you sustain your software infrastructure? Because you're going to build a lot of infrastructure to support an HMI. And you're going to build a lot of hardware infrastructure across all these end-of-lifes like the LCD problem. And how do you track the latest HMI innovations and cost points, whether it's brand new screens, new touch technologies, all those kinds of things. So creating something that is scalable and has longevity and is leverageable, especially on the software side, because you can drive, we all know that one hardware person, engineer, can drive lots of software people crazy. And so churning the hardware because you had to create scalability or whatever it is can create huge sustaining and evolutionary problems for your software team, which gets us into the software problem, right? So the software hardware challenge is probably the biggest architecture decision your company's ever faced. And I say that with a fair bit of experience designing and developing and releasing embedded products over the last, 25, almost 30 years now. And because we are typically, as engineers, doing incremental engineering. We go to our processor vendor, get the next bigger one, the one with bigger memory, the one that, we go from the this family to this family, and it's almost the same, but we just kind of nudge it up a little bit because we ran out of memory. Why do we move those processors? Almost always, go to processing power and run out of memory, right? The software guys burned up the previous thing, and we need to go higher. Well, HMI is driving this massive monkey wrench in terms of processing power, memory and bandwidth into your hardware design, and if you're not careful, you need to go to the next one, and it drives another monkey wrench in. So you've got a couple options, and I've presented four of them here. You can go to a single board computer with Linux, or a single board computer with kind of the Wintel type thing using Windows. You can do what you've always done typically, which is to custom design and keep moving up. Or you can do a leveraged embedded solution where you buy something that isn't Windows and Linux, maybe lower end in terms of the operating system, but still has operating systems, whether it's like a Sega operating system with real stacks and all those things under the hood with software and tools to build your GUI, but you can focus on the application and leverage all the infrastructure. These are radically different paths. And actually, at a Chicago event with Aero Electronics a few weeks ago, I spent an hour and 20 minutes talking about this slide. This is really tough because you can choose to overkill it with Windows or with Linux and handle all kinds of scalability, but your cost structures will be inherently quite a bit higher, and you do have to spend a fair amount of maintaining the platform. It's not free to have Linux. Maintaining a Linux distribution, all that stuff, is very expensive. On the other hand, a custom embedded could be the cheapest theoretical BOM cost. But the reality is the amount of software that you would have to develop for most customers would absolutely overwhelm any cost savings between custom embedded and leveraged embedded. So this decision is really, really tough. And most companies tend to choose, or at least initially, go down the Linux SBC path. What we see is the vast majority of companies that go there because of a Raspberry Pi kind of easy demo type thing end up transitioning over to a leveraged embedded solution because the cost of the BOM cost, the actual product cost, and the sustaining cost related to Linux and SBCs tends to be too high, unless you actually need it, which there certainly are applications where you need that level of complexity and power. And when we get into connectivity, and I'm not going to spend too much time on the IoT here, but IoT is a big deal. I mean, obviously, there's tons of hype on this, and if you probably have a billion white papers sitting in your spam folder or your Flutter folder on IoT. But to quote this fellow at Schneider Electric, who seems to know what he's talking about, and he's writing a new book, and his new book is called Internet of Things, Digitize or Die, a little dramatic. But he has a point that IoT is absolutely inevitable for most of the products that we build in the industrial, medical, and commercial space. And there are lots of proprietary, as well as IT, IoT, and industrial protocols and ports, whether it's inside your box, which is RS-485 with your proprietary protocol or some GPIO. But even the big things that we would consider mainstream, like Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, 4G, they're evolving still. There's lots of new things coming in these areas, narrowband or Cat-M1 on the 4G LTE space, Bluetooth 5 with mesh and Thread. There is a lot of stuff changing in things that we would call mainstream, whether it's IPv4 or IPv6. TLS. TLS is the security protocol that gives you a secure pipe around TCP/IP. But 1.2 is supposed to be replaced at any moment with something. It might be 1.3, and who knows what it be. But crypto is, and security in general, is a destination, and it's not a destination, it's a journey, right? Even IoT protocols like MQTT and CoAP and some of these others are evolving as they, MQTT doesn't do particularly well with over-the-air updates, which content push, which is a big deal. So a lot of this stuff is evolving right now, and although HMI drives the MCU and the RAM and the user experience software architecture, adding comms and control into the equation, and a lot of times you're thinking about combining all into one monster processor, that drives also drives MCU and RAM and peripherals, but very differently. So you've got this other thing happening at the same time as HMI, which is connectivity. Aside from the base connectivity that says that every HMI has to control things, there's this other very, very disruptive and powerful force coming into your architectures around IoT. And so you can choose to create a distributed architecture, like we sell, or you can unify it. Some of my best friends are chip heads, as Brandon introduced me. He talked about my career at Intel and Microchip, and my friends down the road at Microchip live and breathe this stuff, and down the road at Intel. And they like to tell you that you can buy their biggest processor and put it all on one chip. Quite frankly, from my perspective, after 16 years in the chip industry and living my whole career in software, chips are cheap, software's not. And a distributor architecture, which separates your HMI from your comms and control, from your power I/O board, can absolutely liberate your software team to focus less on sustaining engineering and more on innovation. So to bring this home, we've got some fast evolving HMI, and I'm going to throw in there IoT and comms because you really can't talk about HMI without also talking about the disruptive factor of IoT and comms. And in embedded system architectures, these are huge disruptors. They absolutely affect the hardware decisions you make and the path for software that can evolve. And to choosing that wrong path can cause years of anxiety and challenges for your team, and literally backtracks. I've got one customer, I'll just divert. I've got a customer that 4 years ago chose, in that case, to go down a Linux SBC path. And about 2.5 years in, because it was really easy at the beginning, they brought up a BeagleBoard or something like that, and it was really easy to show some demos, and they all agreed that was the right solution, it was scalable, et cetera. 2.5 years later, that whole team was fired. They couldn't execute on commercialization. The demo was easy. Commercialization and sustainability and creating something was very hard for them to get done. So they hired a new team because they believed at that point that the problem was the team, not the decision. A year later, that team was fired again. And when they realized that the team they hired was wrong, because it wasn't about the team, it was about the decision. They had chosen the wrong horse. And so now they're changing their direction and using more of a leveraged, embedded solution. But really, part of the problem was they didn't really understand how to handle fast-evolving HMI and the effects of IoT on their system architecture, and therefore how to choose the elements of it at the hardware level and the software level. And so we've seen a dramatic increase in hardware, software, and supply chain complexity. We've got some big efforts going on at customers where they DIY HMI, if you will, to create the hardware, software infrastructure around which they can build an HMI app, a GUI, right? So they spend tons of energy, you know, maybe buying an OS, like a Sega OS kernel, putting some stacks together or putting some free software together from one of the chip vendors, and then layering on all this infrastructure to create this graphic development and deployment environment. And it's not just about doing a GUI. It's over-the-air upgrades and upgrading the GUI. Because if you think that a GUI is going to go into a device in the field and never get changed, wow, talk to your marketing people. Once they get that GUI on there, it's going to change a lot, and they're going to want a way to deploy it, and that starts getting into IoT. And so this is, gets all wrapped up in this whole thing of you're developing and delivering something a little different than we have in the past, where we would deploy machines and they'd be out there for 10 years and you'd never change them. So this infrastructure to create this ability to upgrade and deploy is a much bigger deal now that you have HMI. So don't think just, how do I put a GUI on my device? Think, how do I solve the problem of having this capability in my products in the field? And so this requires some new engineering management thought processes and engineering thought processes around the total cost of products. It's not just the BOM cost. It's the cost of developing it, sustaining it, and evolving it. And you start amortizing that over 10,000 units a year the company makes, or 5,000 a year, or 2,000 a year, or even 50,000 units a year, and you start to realize how expensive that's adding to the effective BOM cost of your products. So to roll this all the way back, painlessly adding a graphic HMI may be a somewhat of an oxymoron. It may be somewhat impossible because HMI entails a lot of technologies. And so you really want to think about the partners you choose. You want to think about where you're going and how big you want to go. You want to make sure that you understand the limits of what you can see right now and maybe push those limits a little bit about what you need in your company's future, and then choose the partners and the technologies that you need to get there, whether it's at the LCD level and you choose to grow your own hardware and software solution from the bottom up, or whether it's the module level like a Sirius solution where you're buying the pre-built modules with all the software and everything built in and leveraging that and sitting on top of it. And with that, I'll turn that back to Brendan.
Great. Thanks, Terry. That was some really good stuff there. And you as well, Todd, just give some good insight there on things to think about when you're looking at adding an HMI to your platform, whatever that may be. And that brings us into the Q&A portion of the event. So, audience, get those questions coming in, and we'll get to as many of them as we can in the next 10 minutes or so. Let's start off here. There are a couple questions that I can wrap up together for you, Todd. And the first one is, I'll do this in two parts. The first one is, an industry standard size LCD just isn't going to work for the application that's in question here. What are the options? Todd, you there?
You hear me now? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
I had myself on mute there for a while. Okay.
Sure, let me be real quick. Industry standard LCD just isn't going to work for this application in question. So what are the options? We talked about going with standards wherever possible, but sometimes that's just not possible.
Yeah. In those cases, there are, one, you have to have some volume behind your design. Typically, if you're going to get into a custom, you can do that. It's typically hundreds of thousands of dollars of tooling, and then they're going to make you take 25,000 pieces of glass on the line. The second option is you can have some glass cut and have the module made to the size you need. It's also very expensive. It's time-consuming. Yield rates are usually not that good. It's best, you know, everything we run into, we try to stay on a standard size. There are some displays out there now for 1U and 2U high rack applications, and we get those requests quite a bit. So we do have some displays to do those kinds of things, because typically those will fall outside of the standard display size, so forth. So, but if you really need a true custom, it could be pretty pricey.
Great. And here's a real quick follow-up question. It's about CapTouch, and although it's expensive right now, when do you see it coming down to levels of resistive touch, because this person has likes the idea of scale, but they can't justify for justify the cost of CapTouch for more than a couple years?
Yeah, I mean, I think CapTouch will probably always be a little bit of a premium over resistive touch. The one thing that will help bring the price down is the popularity of CapTouch just continues to increase, because everybody's familiar with their smartphones and pads and so forth, and everybody wants that same look and feel. So hopefully volume over time is going to drive that and drive the cost down. There is another option if you're using your CapTouch similar to you would use a resistive touch panel, where you're using it for basically pushing buttons and selecting options and so forth. There is a technology, we call it OGS, it's called a one-glass solution, where the sensor and the cover glass are basically all one part. And that can be a fairly cost-effective solution and still act like a CapTouch.
Great. All right, switching over to Terry real quick. So you touched on the concept of scale a lot during your presentation. This says... 32-bit micro is obviously the baseline for some of the capabilities you were talking about, but why not just run it off of the apps processor?
Right. Well, so they're certainly possible to do HMI on a 16-bit part. There's a variety of 16-bit parts out there that have some little mini graphics controllers and things like that in there. I think the problem is not the cost of the hardware, because, you know, back, 10 years ago, we had 32-bit micros that were under a buck. So your cost delta between 32-bit and 16-bit is fairly insignificant. I think the bigger and that cost delta can be absolutely 1,000 times overwhelmed by your software guys. That will absolutely, if you're a software hardware developer thinking 32-bit versus 16-bit, your software guys will kill you if you choose a 16-bit part compared to a 32-bit part. I started my career on 8051s and 6502s, and quite frankly, life's too short for an 8-bit processor. Not when the price of 32-bit is where it is, and you're moving lots of data and images, and you want to do alpha blending, and you want to do PNGs, and you do want to do all this stuff. Quite frankly, you can, you shouldn't. You can use a 16-bit part, you shouldn't. You really, really should start at 32-bit. Now, certainly you can do a unified architecture where your apps and your controls and your control and your HMI are all done in one. The problem is those are very different parts of the software team. And back to my point that software is expensive and hardware is not. From a partitioned architecture perspective, even on our unified boards where we create HMI and then we do comms and control, we actually put two 32-bit processors on our 2018 platform. The comms control side is a 400 megahertz Cortex-9, which sounds ridiculous, but the price of that processor that I pay is cheaper than the 16-bit part that I used to buy. It's a 400 megahertz Cortex-A9. And the processing on the HMI side, I either on my low end, I'm using a Cortex-A9 400 megahertz, and the high end a dual gigahertz. Because the cost of processing has come down so much, but the cost of software has gone up by 10x. So you've got to, as a hardware and as a whole solution, we partition because we actually can leverage, in our system, of course, we have these off-the-shelf tools for the HMI side that even an intern could build the GUI, versus Conf Control, which is much more of a traditional, you know, C code environment with stacks and TCP/IP. So, you know, you may find in your application, especially if it's a consumer app, that you have to wring every single 50 cents out and the cost of development on software is irrelevant. But for most of our customers in the industrial, medical, commercial space, the cost of development is not irrelevant. You don't have extra software engineers. And with the right hardware architecture, you can actually turn your software engineers from being sustaining engineers and infrastructure engineers to product development and deployment engineers. And that's a big difference.
Wow, that's really good insight there. Before I follow up on that, just a reminder to the audience, keep your questions coming in and we'll get to as many of them as we can. Back to you, Terry. Is there a universal plug-and-play HMI display that can be directly connected to a PLC or embedded system? If not, do you see something like that coming to fruition in the future?
That's an interesting question. So we've all along for many, many years, there have been things like Allen Bradley and Siemens have had these control panels, if you will, for primarily the value-added integrator market where, you know, Jane or Joe, the integrator, is on the factory floor and they're building a process control thing and they've got a PLC and they buy from that PLC vendor one of their HMI panels. Those things are really expensive. If you looked at those, they're like a 7-inch panel is like $2,000-$3,000 versus $200-$300 on the OEM embedded side. Okay, so there's a radical difference in price point there. And quite frankly, although I don't want to bash my buddies over at Siemens and Allen Bradley and stuff, they look like they're from a factory control panel, okay, as opposed to something that you want on your modern, whether it's laboratory equipment or medical equipment, that looks gorgeous and is highly competitive in your industry. So now that doesn't mean that you can't connect to PLCs. I mean, all of our modules have Modbus built in. You slap a 485 transceiver on there, and we can control a PLC directly. Sure. But it's a different kind of market that at least we target, which is more you're building a piece of equipment. You're not a system integrator building a factory process control system. And because you're building a piece of equipment, you want an OEM module, and maybe you need to connect to PLCs. And now, if you start getting into the big iron, these days PLCs aren't just Modbus. There's Ethernet IP. There's all these capabilities around, you know, Industry 4.0. And so you really then start to say, oh, it's not about just about your HMI. It's a big part about the comms, because you need scalability to maybe Ethernet IP or something like that. So there is that's why, again, the partition solution tends to work really well. We have off-the-shelf HMI solutions. That's part of what we do, and there are other companies that do off-the-shelf HMI, which is the screen, memory, processing, software. Everything is an off-the-shelf module. And then partition that with your comm side, which we also sell off-the-shelf comm stuff, where you can innovate the connectivity to PLCs or, you know, Ethernet IP or whatever it is that's on the factory floor or inside your machine. So this is the heart of the architectural problem. It's a great question.
Great. Good stuff there. All right. Back to you, Todd. There's a lot of really cool touch technology, some of them you touched on, no pun intended, in your presentation. But things like gesture and harsh environment capacitive touch are out there now. What do you think about those, and does LXD Research and Display offer any of them? So on mute, Todd.
I'm back. I'm sorry I started talking again. But let me start all over. Yes, LXD, we can provide multi-touch and progressive touch. You swipe, pinch, expand, all of that is supported. Since a lot of our applications are outdoor or in harsh environments or very industrial environments, gloves, moisture, we can provide touch panels and cap touches that could support those environments. Medical is another one. Liquids and gloves are a big application now for those industries.
Great. And what about gesture? Do you see a lot of demand for that coming out of the market?
You know, it depends on the industry. Industrial, not as much. You know, everybody's, you know, pushing a button, doing those types of things, making a machine do some kind of an operation. We can do all of that. A lot of it is on Terry's side on the software, providing all the support there. The hardware is there, and the display has the capability of doing that. it all becomes basically a software job at that point.
Great. Lightning question, Terry, last one we have time for. If you could give me a real quick insight into cost difference between building an HMI platform from scratch versus buying a module.
Simple answer, if you take profitability as a company seriously, it's always cheaper to buy a solution. If you focus on BOM cost and say that the cost of software and maintenance and sustaining and supply chain and all these things are irrelevant, it's cheaper to buy, build it yourself.
Good and concise. There you have it. Well, unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today. And for those of you who had questions that we weren't able to get to, we'll make sure to that the appropriate representatives from LXC Research and Display and or Sirius Integrated follow up. I'd like to thank Todd Balanz, president of LXC Research and Display, and Terry West, CEO of Sirius Integrated, for some really good insight there on what's going on in the HMI world and how you can get one into your commercial, medical, industrial device design. We at Open Systems Media, LXC Research and Display, and Sirius Integrated would also like to thank you, the audience, for contributing some great questions today and for your attendance. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search for the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCasts available for download there as MP3s. Thanks again for attending, and have a great day.